The San Francisco Experience Podcast, brought to you by Jim Herlihy. Independent commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 24, Episode 9, Sparks, China's Underground Historians and Their Battle for the Future. Talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Ian Johnson. In traditional China, dynasties rewrote their history to cover up misdeeds and to amplify their meager successes. In modern-day China also, the Chinese Communist Party does much the same to whitewash the failures such as famines, the Cultural Revolution, and political purges. Xi Jinping in particular knows the power of controlling history to ensure that the CCP remains in power. But Chinese independent writers, artists, and filmmakers, through digital technology, are fighting against this disremembering of what happened in the past. Our guest today is Ian Johnson, who's documented these modern-day chroniclers in his latest book, Sparks. And after all, as the American philosopher George Santayana once said, those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. But how can you remember the past if it's being consciously erased? Ian joins us from his office at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, where he is a senior fellow for Chinese studies. Hello, Ian, and welcome to the show.
Hi, and thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Ian, please take a few moments to tell our listeners about your many years in China, both as a journalist and an author. You were actually expelled from China. Tell us about that. And also, tell us about the Pulitzer Prize.
Well, I first went to China as a student in 1984, which was quite a long time ago now, so I'm dating myself. But it was a very different time, of course, when China was just coming out of the Mao era. Economic reforms were just taking hold, and the country's economy was just starting to come back to life. I went back there in the 1990s as a correspondent for the Baltimore Sun and then for the Wall Street Journal, where I was their first macroeconomics reporter, and covered things like China's joining the World Trade Organization in 2001. I left for another few years and came back around the time of the Summer Olympics and stayed there from 2008 until 2020. You mentioned my expulsion. That came when the Trump administration expelled 58 Chinese journalists, and the Chinese government responded by expelling all of the correspondents for the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. Through the 2010s, I was accredited for the Times, and so I was one of the journalists expelled at that time. And so I've been back to China since then, but I'm no longer working there as a correspondent. You asked for the Pulitzer Prize. That came actually during my first stint. I covered the crackdown on the Falun Gong spiritual movement and the police brutality that was used against protesters then. For that, I won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001.
Very impressive. Let's talk about your book, Sparks. The book recounts your recollections of many thought leaders in China, and it's divided into three sections: the past, the present, and the future. Of course, let's begin with the past. Discussion of purges, famines, re-education, etc. Tell us about some of the people you encountered. And in particular, in your book, you also mentioned Xi Jinping's father and the role that he played during that era. Tell us about him also.
The party basically justifies its right to rule China, because it took power in 1949 after a civil war, defeated the government that was in power at the time, and that's why it took power. But it sort of justifies it by saying that China was going down the tubes in the 1st half of the 20th century, and the Communist Party saved China and took power and brought China back to life and put it on the path to prosperity. And so this is a sort of whitewashing of the past. Of course, just like any national myth, there are elements of the truth in this. China, the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, did bring China back, united the country in 1949. It did put it eventually on the path to prosperity, but there were many hiccups. And through the second half of the 20th century, There was, for example, the worst recorded famine in history, with up to 45 million people dying directly because of government policies, not because of natural disasters or droughts or floods or things like that, but directly because of the party's economic policies. And things like the Cultural Revolution, which was this 10-year-long period of turmoil and chaos that the founder of the People's Republic of China, Mao Zedong, that he launched and resulted also in many people dying and lives upended and things like that. So that tends to be whitewashed. And one of the people who was affected is Xi Jinping's own father, Xi Zhongxun. He got caught up in a purge. It sounds almost laughable in a way, because he was purged because of a historical novel. Again, showing the power of history. This is a novel this person wanted to write about the 1940s, before the party took power, when Mao and the communists were holed up in this base camp in northwestern China. Xi Zhongxun thought, well, that's really sensitive. I better not cooperate with this novelist who had asked him for some interviews, because he had experienced that time. But everyone said to him, oh, we can't hurt. This is just a novelist writing a novel, et cetera, et cetera. So he gave an interview or two to the novelist who wrote this three-part novel, big, long thing, that praised another Communist Party leader and didn't criticize Mao, but didn't praise Mao and made this other person seem like a real hero. And Mao got extremely angry and purged Xi Jinping's father and 20,000 other people. So it wasn't just some little thing. It was a huge purge. And I think this is something that showed the Xi family just how important history was, that history could be really a dangerous thing in an authoritarian state, depending on what side of history you came down. If you were on the quote-unquote right side of history, the side that the leader at the time wanted, then you were fine. If you were on the wrong side of history, you could be purged and your life, your career ended, or even your life ended. So that was a formative event in Xi Jinping's youth, I think.
Now, of course, Xi Jinping turned 70, I think, this year or early next year. So this purging would have happened, let's see, Xi Jinping would have been born in 1953, 1954.
Yes.
So I guess this purge would have taken place in the mid-late 1950s?
62, so he was about 9 years old.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So he would have, Xi Jinping, the current leader, would have a clear memory of this. And how long did that purge last, and how long was the family on the outs with the Mao Zedong regime?
Well, the family was on the outs until Mao died in 1976. And in 1966, so 4 years after the purge, the Cultural Revolution started. The family was really purged. The father was sent off to work. Xi himself, then just a young fellow, was sent to work in a very poor part of the country as a farmer. His half-sister was persecuted so strongly that she committed suicide. So the family suffered quite a bit, and only came back to prominence but in the late 70s, after Mao had died and the new, more moderate leadership around Deng Xiaoping took control of the party and the country.
Now, who were some of the other characters, the writers, filmmakers, documentarists that you came across who were active during that period of the past in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, which of course was a tumultuous time for China?
Well, I'll mention two people. One is somebody who lived through that era. His name was Gao Artai. And Mr. Gao was an artist and a writer. He was persecuted, lived in a notorious labor camp, where thousands of people starved to death during the Great Famine. He eventually wrote up his memoirs, which have been partially translated in English as In Search of My Homeland. That's a really fine piece of writing. He still is alive. He's almost 90 years old now, and he actually lives in Las Vegas because he immigrated to the United States after Tiananmen, after 1989, and his wife got a job in the post office.
My goodness.
And they had a slot open in Las Vegas. It seems really funny. I went and visited him recently, but Vegas, the landscape around there for people who've been there, it's very arid, right? And, and it looks a lot like Western China in this area where he had lived for so many decades of his life. So he said he really likes it quite a lot. So he's one person, and he showed me these scraps of paper that he wrote his impressions and it became the basis of his memoir. Little tiny scraps of paper, maybe 2 inches wide and about 3 inches, 4 inches long, and he'd fold them up, and he was wearing padded clothing. If you ever see these sort of padded Chinese jackets, cotton jackets, and he'd tear open a little hole and stick it into the padding so that even if his home was ransacked and it was constantly being ransacked by authorities looking for any incriminating evidence, they never found this. And he eventually smuggled it out of the country. And he has many photo albums full of this sort of amazing record of that time. So he's somebody who's still active. There's another person who I think is really interesting. She's a feminist scholar, a turned documentary filmmaker, Ai Xiaoming, who's made many works, especially a very ambitious, long 4.5-hour documentary about that prison camp where Mr. Gao had served. And she went there and did a film about people trying to commemorate it. So it's about the past, but it's also about the present, because it's about the efforts to remember the past and not to forget it, which is, of course, the government's goal.
Let's move on to the present. Before we went on the air, I was telling you about the APEC conference here in San Francisco 2 weeks ago. And of course, Xi Jinping, the leader, came to the conference. China, of course, is a member of APEC, came to the conference and on the sidelines had a summit with President Biden. The Chinese media contingent attending the conference was huge. TV, print material, social media, correspondence, very strong, very large contingent. Tell me about the writers, the authors, the documentarists in today's China who are dealing with a media which is quite sophisticated, technology-driven. They don't have to write on little bits of paper and stuff it in a padded jacket. As you said at the outset, more often than not, the story begins with a kernel of truth, and then the perspective, the historic perspective, and the spin, I guess, that's put on it, is one that, you know, it's one that's consistent with the CCP narrative. Tell us about some of the present individuals who are speaking out on these topics.
Yes, you mentioned the press contingent from China at APEC. And that's a really good point, because the government spares no expense in telling its version of the past. It has a monopoly over school textbooks, of course, complete control over that. It has a monopoly over what people watch on television, the movies that they can see. If you go to an exhibition, there's really no alternative film festivals anymore, especially over the past 10 years of this really tight control. And so it would appear that the government holds all the cards, and that they can just ram through their version of the past and no one could possibly stand up against it. But in today's China, especially over the past 20 years, there's been the use of very simple digital technologies. And I'm not talking really about social media, but very simple things that we take completely for granted. One of them are PDFs. Mm-hmm. PDFs are something that allow you, as you know, to create your own magazine or book. You can write it, you can lay it out, you can put in pictures, and then you can email it to somebody else. You don't need a printing press. You don't need a photocopy machine. You don't need a mimeograph machine, you know, from a few decades ago or anything like that. You can just do this on your laptop for free, essentially. And there are very sophisticated journals, history journals that are done like that. There's one called Remembrance, which has been publishing since 2008. I just got the 245th issue in my inbox last week. This is the PDF. It also allows you to republish and rediscover things that have been erased. So a book that might be out of print or which is banned, you can, if you can get a hold of a digital copy of it, or you can scan it into a digital version, you can start sending it to people. So that's another thing that we kind of take this for granted, but it's a weapon of the weak in this asymmetrical battle. And I think the other thing which I'd mention, which again we take for granted, are digital cameras. We have them in our phones, but if you just have even a cheap handheld camera for a couple of, you know, a few hundred bucks, you can make really high quality film with that. Don't need a tripod even. You can cut it on your laptop. If you think 30 years ago how you made a documentary film, you needed cutting equipment, you needed a big camera, you needed all this stuff that basically only a big movie studio or television station might have. But now anybody can make a film. And the woman I mentioned just a few minutes ago, Ai Xiaoming, the feminist scholar, she's made 24 films, all of them on her own with basically no budget, looking at all kinds of things in the past. There have been hundreds of these films made over the past 20 years.
We tend to think of the current regime in Beijing as being a very authoritarian regime, and of course one that tightly controls information. Yet the way you just related the story about the PDF and the fact that you're able to receive the 245th edition of this journal makes me wonder, first of all, what would happen if the author of that journal were caught? But secondly, if they've just published the 245th edition, this has been going on for some time, probably a number of years. And is this completely under the radar screen? Do the authorities know about it? I'm sure they do. And if they do know about it, why would they not crack down on it?
They do crack down on the most prominent of the people involved. For example, the filmmaker I mentioned earlier, Ai Xiaoming, she's not allowed to leave China, and she faces constant harassment. Recently, some students, a grad seminar at Stanford, they wanted to screen one of her films and have her zoom in to talk to the students. Just before that was to happen, her internet connection was cut. And then for about 3 hours, she had no internet. When the seminar was over, she had her internet again. So the police harass her and people like her in many different ways. The journal that I mentioned, Remembrance, it's harder to stop because it's a group of people who are doing this. And this is also something that's changed a bit, and this is maybe where we almost segue into the future. What's happened over the past 5 years or so is that there's more and more people in overseas exiled Chinese communities who are getting involved and helping out. That journal particularly is laid out and put together by grad students in the United States and Texas, by Chinese grad students. So they get these submissions from China and they put the magazine together and then they email it back into China. And that way there's no one person, there's not an organizational structure that you can just decapitate and end. There are these individuals who are working on it and they have a little bit of help with overseas communities. And this is very interesting because I don't think that flow back and forth between inside and outside China was so prominent in the past, but it's really started to pick up in recent years.
It's interesting that you mentioned the influence of the U.S. the Chinese grad students here at U.S. universities. Interesting data point that I picked up on when I was at the APEC conference. There are over 200,000 Chinese students studying at universities here in the United States. Apparently, that number is down from about 300,000 at its peak a few years ago. So there's quite a large contingent of Chinese students who are here in the United States, many studying all sorts of subject matter on the tech side, business, medicine, the humanities, etc. So there's a very large population of Chinese-speaking nationals who are here at universities who could participate in this and who could be editing and putting these journals together and sending them back to China. Two questions there. We hear about the Chinese firewall, that the internet in China is almost like a fortress. Number one, how do those PDFs get through that fortress-like Chinese firewall? And number two, well, let's come on to talk about AI when we talk about the future. Tell me, how would the students here in the United States who are editing these journals, how are they able to send them into China?
Well, the Chinese firewall, the Great Wall of China, or the Great Firewall of China, as people say, it's not it's not 100% strong. There are software known as VPNs, virtual private networks, which allow you to jump over the firewall.
I see.
The people I write about in China, they all have that. So I'd say most public intellectuals in China, I'm thinking here not of just a few dozen people, but of thousands of people, have that. Even if VPN usage in China is very hard to quantify, but even if you just took 1%, you'd still be talking about a billion internet users in China. That would still be roughly 10 million people. So and these people are often have a gatekeeper function. Last year, there were protests in China related to the COVID lockdowns and to the slowing economy and a variety of other things. We saw a lot of examples of videos of these protests being uploaded to YouTube or to Twitter, and then Chinese people then downloading it, repackaging it in a different format, and sending it into Chinese social media where, you know, might be blocked and so on and so forth. But there was this cat and mouse game where there were clearly a lot of people with VPNs who were able to access this. And I think that that's probably a change because, you know, if you think the past 30, 40 years in China, things have been pretty good.
Yes.
You've had almost double-digit economic growth through the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, even into the 2010s. But the past few years have been a series of problems. Mm-hmm. The COVID lockdowns, which were really, really harsh and really unpopular, especially by 2022, when the rest of the world was using mRNA vaccines and sort of moving on. People in China were like, we still haven't used, why aren't we using mRNA vaccines? Why aren't we unlocking our economy and our people? And then the economy has been slowing, mm-hmm. Probably as a result of that, but also for other reasons, such as demographic challenges,
yes,
and so on. And I think this is cumulatively the biggest challenge that people under the age of 40 have experienced. You probably have to go back to 1989, Tiananmen, the massacre there in Beijing. That was 34 years ago. So basically anybody under 40 wouldn't have much of a memory of that, mm-hmm. or have experienced it at all. And so for them, this is quite a change, what's going on now. They're with real challenges and questions about the party's ability to lead China. You know, it seemed like in the past they could say, hey, we've got double-digit economic growth. We are the technocratic, meritocratic geniuses that are leading China to prosperity. And you kind of go, well, I don't really like the party, but they are doing a pretty good job on the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're kind of like, a lot of people are like, well, they're not even doing a good job on that, and they're still harsh and authoritarian. So that trade-off doesn't seem so good anymore, and I think that's driving a lot of this opposition to the state. Mm-hmm. And the exploration of the past to look for different explanations for what went wrong.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to the future. During the summit between President Biden and President Xi Jinping, one of the subjects that was on their agenda was actually artificial intelligence. They talked about setting up a committee to compare notes and just to make sure that, you know, we have an opportunity to kind of look over their shoulder and vice versa. Tell me about the impact that you think artificial intelligence is going to have in getting the word out and making sure that people in China know about history. Has the barn door been opened and can't be closed? Has the horse bolted, in other words, with the advent of AI and the future ability of Chinese individuals to access the past and the history as a result of what's likely to happen as a result of AI?
The AI is a real double-edged sword. It will allow people to create, well, there'll be all kinds of new creations that people can do in terms of film and so on and so forth. The experience we've had with fakes and deep fakes will become an even bigger challenge. I saw something recently. It was this Chinese tech company called Baidu, and they also have an AI thing similar, say, to Google's Bard or ChatGPT. And somebody said, send me a picture of Tank Man. And Tank Man was this person who in 1989, his famous picture, which many people might have seen, of this row of tanks on Tiananmen Square, and there's one person standing in front of the tank, mm-hmm. and sort of like standing them off and saying, don't come here, don't come, and so standing trying to prevent the tanks from coming. The version, the Chinese AI version of that, was a picture of a guy taking a selfie in front of a tank. And so he's got his arm out and he's holding his phone, which is, of course, completely anachronistic because there were no smartphones back then in 1989, right? But he's taking a selfie, and behind him, he's like doing the peace sign, you know, which a lot of people do. So they're like, hey, here I am. Haha, I'm on Tiananmen Square. And there's a tank behind me.
Yes.
Just to make it into some campy sort of experience. And so somebody might say, well, that's Tank Man. It looked like it was no big deal, right? So that's the kind of thing. And that was kind of not very successful for us. But that's the kind of thing, though, in a more sophisticated way that can really make things complicated. But then again, not just for China, but for all of us, because we have such a hard time nowadays in distinguishing fact from fiction. This is going to be a big issue in China and elsewhere. And, you know, initially I think that it's probably going to be work in the government's favor because the government will have control of this technology. But then how it plays out 5 years from now, 10 years from now, I think it's anyone's guess.
Mm-hmm. Are there any identifiable individuals who will be leading the charge, whether it's in AI or in other technologies, to make sure that the Chinese people are aware of their history?
Well, one of the people I profile in the book a lot is a Chinese writer. Her name is Zhang Xue. That's her pen name. And she has written many essays and articles. It's probably one of the most popular writers in this movement. She does make use of technology, but I mean, it's primarily, I think, the force of her writing, which makes her so popular. And I think she's someone to keep an eye on. You know, other than that, there are still these documentary filmmakers who are making films that circulate around China that will continue to affect people, I think.
Just coming back for a minute to internal surveillance. Again, we know that China is an authoritarian state, that there is a very comprehensive national surveillance structure in China. In fact, one of the numbers that I've seen is that the national surveillance budget is estimated to be about 10% of GDP, which is almost at the same level the national defense budget. If that's the case, that implies to me that the infrastructure for internal surveillance is even more widespread, and that the regime is putting an awful lot of resources into internal surveillance. Is that will that be a continuing growth industry, if you will, in China, and making it harder and harder for future writers and journalists to try to document history?
It will be a challenge, but I think it's also a challenge for the government, because the government faces a whole host of challenges as it tries to move from being a mid-income country to being a high-income country on a par with, say, the United States and other developed countries. And it needs every penny it can get. It has, in the countryside, education is poor, healthcare is poor. There's a whole host of social challenges that China faces. Mm-hmm. And if you blow a lot of your money on things like internal surveillance, this is money that can't be spent on the things that China really needs to spend its money on.
Mm-hmm.
And I experienced East Germany before the wall fell in 1988. And we're all familiar maybe with the Stasi, the East German secret mm-hmm. police. I think it was something at the peak of it, 1 in 15 people was working or informing for the Stasi. Mm-hmm. And this became a crippling burden on East Germany. And China has a much more vibrant economy than those East Bloc countries did back then in the Cold War. But it's still, money is a zero-sum game in a budget, right? And you have to, if you're putting money on that, you're not putting it into other things that you need to do. And a lot of this is also really, although people imagine that, you know, China does have closed circuit television, that is also linked up through some gigantic brain that surveys people. But actually, a lot of it is boots on the ground. It's personnel, it's people. There's one guy I did a vignette on in the book who lives on the outskirts of Chengdu, a city in southwestern China, and where he runs a little cafe now. And he, by his counting, there are 6 to 8 police officers who watch him, because they're in shifts, you know, and they have mm-hmm. to work on Saturdays and so on and so forth. This is a huge outlay. It's not like there's some like giant public security bureau with millions of people in Beijing who send them down to this, to the localities. This is on the local government, right? Mm-hmm. They say, hey, you got to keep an eye on this guy. And so you're the local police chief, you've got a whole bunch of things going on, and now you got to send six officers to look after this old geezer who's running a cafe. It's a big burden, right? And this is something people... Yeah, so it was the same thing with zero COVID. It almost, one of the reasons I got rid of it after a while was it was bankrupting the local governments to have to do these tests all the time, and millions of people in a city having to have nasal swabs, and then all the tests having to be evaluated and so on. It's very, all of these things cost a lot of money, and it's a problem, I think, for the country longer term.
Well, they not only cost a lot of money, they're also non-productive from the point of view of growing GDP. China, as you recounted earlier, through the 80s, 90s, 2000s, even into the to the 2010s, has had phenomenal economic growth rates. The pie, the economic pie, if you will, has grown bigger, bigger, bigger. And so, as a result, millions, tens of millions of Chinese have become wealthy, have become comfortable, have become middle class. But if 10%, if that number is correct, of GDP is being allocated to internal security, that is probably the least productive use of national treasure, if you will. And in a country, and again, you mentioned demographics in China, I read that up to 24% of Chinese youth are unemployed. And again, that's a, you know, that's another festering potential problem for the future.
Yeah, and the demographic challenges are huge because of the decades of the single child policy. You have one kid with four grandparents. And so from a tax point of view, you don't have that many people who are having to support an increasingly aging population. So that money would be better spent on elderly care and other challenges like that. So I think in the future, we're probably going to see more of these kind of tensions percolating up from below. That we had this golden age for China's economy. It's not that the country's going to go away or going to become a basket case or it's going to become the next Soviet Union, which kind of implodes on its lack of economic growth. But it's certainly not going to be the country that's synonymous with go-go economic growth that we had over the past few decades. It's one that's going to be... that will still be a force to be reckoned with on a whole host of technologies and so on and so forth, not to mention the military. But it's going to be one that probably has a lot more challenges than we're used to thinking of when we think of China.
Well, Ian, in the remaining few minutes of the podcast, what are your closing thoughts about China, about the future, and most importantly, about making sure that, that people have a sense of their history? Every time I have an opportunity to chat with someone from China, I'm always reminded of their culture and how it's a 4,000-year-old, 5,000-year-old culture. And certainly every Chinese person that I come across seems to be aware of that and reminding me of that. So if they're aware that they have this long cultural history, how does that jibe with a sort of a desert as regards history, history of the last 50, 100 years, last 25 years? How does that jibe? On the one hand, you know, Chinese people are very conscious of their long, long history and culture, yet for the last 50, 100 years, either they're not aware of the history or the history, they suspect that the history is very one-sided. How do you think that the average Chinese person is going to be able to reconcile those two competing views of China?
Well, people do take great pride in Chinese history, and it's something that always fascinated me. That's why I loved living in China. The bucket list of places to go to, the longer you live there, the longer my bucket list got, because there were just more and more places that you could experience and see. And I think people are rightly proud of that and rightly fascinated by it. That's why I think it's hard for the government to simply sort of whitewash the recent, say, 75 years. Because China is a country where people, even on a popular level, are obsessed with the past. They're very interested in it. Mm-hmm. And throughout Chinese history, historians have had a very exalted place. Historians were the judge and juror of the past. They're the people who determine whether a dynasty or whether a government had the right to rule, whether they're doing a good job or a bad job. So this means, you know, a lot of people are very, very interested in the past, and this makes history, an almost sacred profession in China. So I think that this kind of a battle is going to continue to go on. The people I write about are all motivated by the great historians of the past in China and see themselves as heirs of this long tradition, speaking truth to power and offering alternative viewpoints despite what the government might want.
And Ian, where can our listeners buy a copy of Sparks, which documents the past, the present, and the future of China dealing with its history?
Well, you can buy a copy in any bookstore or online. It's widely distributed. I've also I'm starting a website which is due to launch on December 13th, called the China Unofficial Archives. And this has been a personal project I've been working on for the past while to offer all of these zamizdat, these underground publications, books, and movies, everything that's in the public domain is available on this site. And you can sort it by era, topic, and format. So if you want to say movies on the Cultural Revolution, you can filter movie and Cultural Revolution, and then you can get the movies that we have on our site. We're building it out. It's a work in progress, but we've got some people, we've got a small grant to do this, and we're going to keep working on this over the next 6 months or so. But we're going to launch it just to get it going in the middle of December. So people who want to can check that out also.
And the title of that again is?
China Unofficial Archives. The URL is a bit complicated, but I could offer, if anybody's interested, they can contact me via my website. It's ian-johnson.com. There's a contact thing, and I just go straight to my Gmail, and I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone has.
And Ian, do you have an X handle? How can our listeners follow you on LinkedIn or other social media?
Yeah, I have an X handle. It's at Ian Dennis Johnson. Dennis spelled with one N. Ian Dennis Johnson. That's also my Instagram, I think my Facebook page, and so on. I'm on LinkedIn as well.
Well, Ian, once again, thank you very much for joining us today. Very thorough overview of your time in China. Just judging from the enthusiasm in your voice as you related this, of course, the book, and then your experiences there, it sounds as though you left a little part of yourself there in China.
Oh, for sure. I lived there for 20 years, most of my adult life, and I really enjoyed it and hope to go back in the future, but probably more as a tourist and visitor rather than working full-time.
Well, Ian, once again, thank you so much for joining us. And for our listeners, today's episode is number 476. The San Francisco Experience is carried on Apple, Spotify, Pandora, 18 platforms in total, with listeners in 60 countries. FeedSpot has recently recognized us as a top 25 California news podcast. This has been the San Francisco Experience Podcast with Jim Herlihy, coming to you from San Francisco.